I'm TJ Manisterski, and this is my Coaching Project podcast, where I connect with leaders in search of breakthrough knowledge. Breakthrough knowledge challenges the status quo, changes your opinion, or fundamentally opens your eyes in a way there is no turning back. Today, I'm with Laura Bellamy. She is a Harvard grad and a standout goaltender for the Crimson, competing in the national tournament twice. Her 19 shutouts are second in the program history. And as a senior, she led the nation with a goals against average of just 0.92. Laura was also a two-time captain, which is incredibly rare for anyone, in particular a goaltender. Following her playing career, Laura jumped right in behind the bench with Harvard for two seasons, which included another trip to the national tournament and a berth in the title game. She's now back in her home of Duluth, Minnesota as an associate head coach with the University of Minnesota Duluth. Laura, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's an honor to be on it with you.
Well, that's terrific. And when you read your bio and those accolades, it's really cool to see just how much experience you have in those big moments as a player and as a coach to be in national tournament games, national title games with the trophy on the line. And it leads right into our discussion today, where we've both read the book Primed to Perform by Neil Doshi and Lisa McGregor, which talks about building high-performing cultures through total motivation. And if we use that book as our framework today, you know, we're looking at the most powerful direct motivators of play, purpose, and potential. And it speaks directly to your experiences of in those biggest games, we want our players to play their best. And we also want to create an environment where we are fostering individual development, we're expediting that growth, and also building team chemistry so that we're having this optimal individual experience inside of this team environment. And I think so often as coaches, we tend to think that to motivate our team, it's through our words or our actions, and somehow we will put motivation from our brains to their brains, where what we're going to talk about today is really creating an environment that creates that motivation. So let's jump right into the motivator of play. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that one.
What I love about it is it's when, you know, doing the activity. So for our players, like getting out there and playing hockey, that is the reward for them. They feel like a kid out on the rink. And, you know, just in thinking of examples that we've sort of used since I read this book, a big one is getting out on the outdoor rink with our team. So we had tried to do that for the first couple of years at Duluth, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't based on weather or whatever else. But since reading this book, I've tried to make sure we get out there every year, and it's so fun to watch. I mean, so many kids, especially, we have a lot of Minnesotans on our team. A lot of them grew up on outdoor rinks, and some of our players have never played on an outdoor rink. So to see them out there sort of just, getting in touch with the kid who first put on skates is, it's really fun. And I think one really good example for us, maybe not something that we do every day, but it's always fun to see our kids go back to when they first started playing.
Yeah, that's true. Just connecting back to the magic of the game and how the origin of the game was certainly played outdoors and on ponds. And I grew up in the Toronto area, and maybe not a whole lot of pond hockey, but outdoor hockey was prevalent. We have these outdoor rinks throughout the city. And some of my fondest memories of playing the game was playing at nighttime with my cousins and their friends and the lights, you know, the outdoor lights at night on this rink that was outdoors. And there is something so magical about it. And when you think about play as being a motivator, you just look at kids. Like, kids just want to play. And I'm seeing firsthand right now, because I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old boys. All they want to do is play. But when you think about us, like you and I, we all want to play. It's all, I think our sense of what play is changes and evolves. So we're fortunate that we actually don't have to work for a living because we get to coach. So it's not, you know, beats working for a living, but we're playing every day. It's fun for us. Like, we enjoy every aspect of it. You wake up in the morning and you're saying, like, you can't wait to get there. You know, you don't need the alarm clock. You're not worried about, oh man, today's going to stink or whatever. Not to say there aren't challenges, but I really do think there's a sense of play there. And I think when you are playing, what we see is it really just creates space for learning and experimentation, reflection, problem solving, and leading to adaptive performance. So when you're able to try something and work through the problem, learn from it, and then reattack it, and sort of on your own terms to a certain extent, like, that's fun. And I think regardless whether you're playing, in the case of my kids, like dinosaurs, or you're playing pond hockey, or trying to figure out the penalty kill, it's all kind of the same. Now, what are you doing regarding, like, small area games, fun and competition in practice? Is that something that you found has been beneficial for maybe incorporating a sense of play into your everyday?
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's like you said, we as people, like, we want to, and our players, you see it with them, particularly in small area games, they want to be given a problem to solve and try it, and maybe it goes well, maybe it doesn't, and if it doesn't, they have the opportunity to adapt and figure it out on their own. And as a coach, that's one of the most rewarding things to watch on a daily basis. So small area games is a huge part of that. Our head coach, Maura Kroll, I would say she's been ahead of that curve of small area games. She's been doing it for a long, long time. And I think a lot of that comes from the X's and O's side of it, you know, taking things we do and putting them in tighter spaces and having our players figure out how to have success in a smaller area. And then when we get on a rink, you know, so you feel like you're on an Olympic sheet essentially. But the play side of it, the getting our players back to, you know, being creative and maybe when we're setting up a small area game, giving a few rules, so to speak, but leaving quite a bit to their imagination and see what they do, see how they try to score goals. That part of it, I think, as a coach is, like I said, not only rewarding, but the growth that takes place from that is, I mean, it's just, I think you can get so much more out of it. And the book talks about it too, just self-directed learning. I think you see that a ton in small area games.
Yeah, it's really neat when you can decrease the player's reliance on the coaches. And I think a lot of times players have been almost ingrained to be totally reliant on the coach. And sometimes it's the silliest thing. Like, they'll ask questions they actually know the answer to. And I've gotten a lot more comfortable with just responding with, well, what do you think? And usually they know the answer. And if they don't, you're sort of giving them permission to, okay, I can figure this out. Let me think about it for a second, right? And it's funny you mentioned the self-directed learning. And I think that's so much of what play is, right? The autonomy to make decisions, try something, not to be reprimanded if there's a mistake made, but allowed to see, you know, how it could improve, and the art of coaching, of knowing when and how to provide feedback or not at all, and let them sort of work that out on their own to create that space for that learning for them is crucial. And I think there's room for this in the idea of team tactics as well. The idea of, like, a commander's intent, which is, like, in the military, you have commander's intent, meaning, hey, we have an objective. We're going to give you the end state that we want. So, but then it's going to be up to you as a group to figure out how that's going to happen and not to micromanage every step along the way, allowing room for that problem solving and adapting along the way.
Your point there about, you know, getting more comfortable as a coach, asking a question back, you know, what did you see? What do you think? It's, I think it, It is so, I mean, it's something I've learned over the last couple of years that has really changed how I view coaching. I think, you know, especially early on, I felt like I needed to have an answer to everything. You know, that's my job as a coach. And, you know, maybe sometimes that's true, but, you know, there's a few reasons why asking a question can be really valuable. One that comes to mind is, you know, I guess an example would be like a D on a rush. You know, if they play a rush incorrectly and I'm teaching, you know, here's how you need to play, here's how we want you to play a 3-on-2, it doesn't really matter what I say about that if the way they read the rush was that it was a 2-on-2. So asking, you know, hey, what did you see on that play? Asking that more often has just, it has really shed light for me on what the player is actually seeing rather than, you know, what I saw. And it has just created an environment for better learning. But the other part about that with self-directed learning and going back to play, I mean, you look back at when we were kids and we went in the yard to play capture the flag, you know, no one told us how that had to be played. We came up with our own rules based on how we wanted to play it and the yard and, you know, the front yard and the backyard, what the rules needed to be based on the differences. I mean, kids come up with that on their own. So later in life, to take away that creativity really doesn't make any sense. And there's just so many good examples from when we're kids where we learned so much on our own. Why not create that for players as coaches now? And like you said, even in a, from a tactical standpoint too. So that's just one example that comes to mind for me.
Well, you're right. And the other thing that happens sort of from that schoolyard image that I got when you described that is conflict resolution. So you got to establish the rules of the game you're playing, which are totally up to you as the participants. You don't have a coach or a parent or somebody telling you, here are the constraints, here's how you must play. It's you're figuring it out together. So when your players are put into situations where they get a chance to figure something out together, determine their own stance or set of rules or standards, like having players involved, for instance, in setting your team standards, can be very powerful. And this is part of the reason why. But then when something's going to go wrong or there might be gray area, now they've got to work out the problem. Like, is that a goal? Was it against the rules? Like, how does that work in our game? And you're putting them into different scenarios where now they have to work together and come to a consensus or a conclusion based on some problem. And you're actually bringing them together in a different way. And you're not only, I think, inspiring the individual, but you're also building team chemistry.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, that's goes into purpose, I guess, which is the next direct motive. And I think, you know, one thing to say too about play is that it's fun, right? You know, when we're talking about night games and capture the flag and those things, like that's fun. And that's how kids had fun, and that's how our players have fun, whether it's small area games or even problem solving team standard wise. And, you know, that competition and fostering play, like you're talking about, it leads to purpose and team chemistry. And that's, you know, I think we, as a coach or even just as a player, I've always, and I think most people would say, I've understood the importance of team chemistry, but what I liked about the book and the direct motive of purpose, which maybe I'll let you kind of explain it a little bit, but is that connectedness, it actually is important in a scientific way in their case studies and their research. I guess I can let you define it and how team chemistry comes into play.
Well, I think that the thing about purpose is you are connecting to a sense of something that might be bigger than yourself. Right. And you're also creating ownership and empowerment for the athletes inside of that environment. And some things that have been helpful for me, and you know, your program is no different, but every program has their own points of pride that you can pull from. And if you can tell stories, I think there's a real power in telling stories of your program. There's going to be defining moments in the history of your program. There's going to be artifacts that you're going to see around the rink or up in on the room in the locker room or in the coach's office or different places that tell stories as well. It may even be like we have a big kind of ugly piece of wood that we hammer pucks into. Like that's an artifact and it's strategically placed in an area that you're going to see it, you know, when I want them to see it. You know, the role of alumni, you know, and having people come back and speak and highlighting remarkable outcomes of players that have gone on from your program. I think all these things are tools to shape an environment that creates a sense of purpose for a player. I also think, like I mentioned, the ownership and the empowerment part allows the players to become more connected to that purpose. So like developing standards, as I mentioned a moment ago, when the players can be involved in the process of developing what standards are important to them, they immediately become more connected to them. They're more likely to adhere to them and they're meaningful. And a great example I have is from my second or third season here at Curry College, our players had a player meeting. I didn't even know what I was doing at the time. It just kind of struck sort of dumb luck, but I was hitting on these motivators. I had them do a player meeting. I just set some end goals. I say, I'd like you to set a goal for academics, community, and hockey. Go. And what they came back with was unbelievable. And the thing was they wanted a 3.5 team GPA. At the time, we were right around a 3.0, which was still very good. And I thought to myself, wow, that's incredible. I don't think that's ever going to happen in my mind. But I didn't say that to them, of course. I said, oh, this is a great goal. Okay, how are we going to get there? And so on and so forth. Let's create a plan. Like coaches like to make plans. So we did. And, but sure enough, they chipped away at it and they got it and they hit it. And you know, it's been 12 semesters. So 6 years since we've never dropped below that 3.5. And I think about that all the time, because if I had walked in the room that day and said, okay, guys, our goal is going to be a 3.5 team GPA, I believe their response would have been similar to mine, which was no way. Like that's not possible. And I don't think they ever would have hit it. I really believe that. So having the players involved and connecting to that purpose is can be really powerful.
Yeah, that's a really good example. And, you know, it's that bigger than me mentality of like, this is something more important than just my individual performance or what I do on a daily basis. It's so powerful. I mean, that is purpose. And that's a good example of it that you just had. You know, a couple of things come to mind in our program. One thing we talk about is, you know, the team is going to change from year to year, and maybe the team identity or how the team plays might change a little bit, but the program is the program. You know, that's a bigger thing. That's UMD winning 5 NCAA championships. That's the history. That's the alums. That's the 32 Olympians. I mean, you could go on and on. And like you said, it's different for every program. That's how it looks for us. But that, you know, we have that conversation with our players from year to year, and it comes up often. And you kind of see the light in their eyes change a little bit, like, right. You know, it's not only that this team is there, there's me and then there's the team, but then there's the program. And this is something that I want to see go on for a long time and have success. And it is a motivator. And you know, another example I thought of when it comes to connectedness is how much you can see players hold each other accountable and make each other better, almost in a more powerful way than we could as coaches. We have two players in particular who have played together since they started skating, probably 6 or 7. So they played on the same line all through high school. We're two of the best players to ever come through Minnesota girls high school hockey. Now they play together here, and whenever they're on the same line together, how connected they are, and that's how they describe it. We are so connected. We're like sisters, you know, and the way they communicate constantly, they're always, you know, I think for some players, it's a little shocking how much they get after each other. You know, if it's a mistake or a play that one of them makes that they don't like, I mean, they'll tell each other and they can be honest, and it's because they're so connected. There's a ton of trust there, and they make each other better every single day because they're so connected, and their purpose is greater than themselves. It's to make each other better, their line better, the team better. And, you know, you just watch that as a coach, and there's no way we could possibly provide for them what they provide for each other because they're so connected.
You hit on such an important part of culture there, which is you're driving performance with your culture. That's the purpose of it, right? It's not, what culture is not here to do is to create harmony and everybody feeling good and, you know, group hugs. Hopefully everybody's best friends. That would be great. But really, it doesn't matter if you're best friends. It's that we work together as a team to accomplish a goal, and it's about performance. And what you described there is essentially like the definition that I read in Mike Babcock's book, Leave No Doubt. He's got this glossary in the back of like key terms. And one is kitchen table accountability. That's his term. And what he describes is you're sitting around the kitchen table with your brothers and sisters, mom and dad and whoever, and nobody's letting anybody off the hook with their crap. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's when you can get to a point where you have that level of trust, where these two certainly have that you're describing, where they can get after each other. And you want to be able to have that in your room for as many players, hopefully all of them, if you can. And that's when you know you have, a high trust environment where the accountability, it's acceptable for somebody to hold someone else accountable. But then in that moment when that's happening, I think it's so important for the person who's being held accountable, how do they respond to that? Are they mature enough to just sort of accept it? Or are they going to make, you know, get their nose all out of joint? Or how does that interaction go is a really interesting dynamic.
It is. And it's, I mean, I love the point you make about harmony too. I mean, what's important, because culture is such a buzzword, I guess you could say, and something that, you know, coaches talk about it, and really leaders of businesses. I mean, so many places around us, people are focused on that. But what are we trying to do with creating a good culture, a culture that we, you know, if we're successful in creating the culture that we want, what does that really mean? And for us, it's driving performance. So I'm glad you made that point that, you know, not everyone's going to be best friends. And in fact, I think these two players might say they're not, you know, best friends off the ice, but on the ice, they have great chemistry, as people call it, you know, and we've actually had conversations. What do you think that means? What is chemistry for you guys? Some of it is knowing where the other one's going to be because they've played together so much, but more of it is, you know, if I recall in a conversation we had, they said it's we come back to the bench, we talk about what happened, good or bad, and they feel extremely comfortable, to your point about how feedback is received. They feel extremely comfortable saying whatever they think, and the other one is going to come back with, you know, most of the time, come back with a comment or a response that's doing what the other one just did, which is they're just trying to make each other better, drive each other's performance. And really, it's like you said, you try to have that with all your players. So I think the more players on your team who can be comfortable not only holding someone else accountable but being held accountable, that probably the more success you're going to have, or you're at least going to set yourself up for strong performance.
Yeah, totally. So I'm going to jump to potential now, the third of our direct motivators that we're discussing today. And when you think about potential, it's really about helping our players connect their work and their effort to their personal goals and their needs. Are there any things that you've done in a player development standpoint where you found that to be beneficial or helpful in this process?
I think one thing that comes to mind is just the way we define development and sort of how we set it up with our players and coaches. Coach Stone, my college coach, always said this, and Coach Kroll says this at UMD too. You know, we're going to help with your development, but it's up to you to take control of your development. And which is kind of interesting because it goes back to play, really, self-directed learning, problem solving, you know, being able to self-assess. So, and I actually just kind of made that connection, but I think it's so powerful, and it's important for our players to know, kind of going back to the teacher and the student or the coach and the player too. It's not always going to be, I have this question, what's the answer? It might be, well, here's a place where you could potentially go find the answer. That might be the response as a coach. Or, well, what do you think? Where do you think you might find the answer? What do you see here in video? That's been a really powerful one. Early on in my coaching career, you know, sitting a player down, showing them all the clips, and a lot of times pointing out mistakes, which gets into indirect motives, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But and really flipping that on its head and sitting down and saying, I have all the clips here for you, but what do you see? You know, that's really what's more important. And I think that drives, I think that's such an important driver in player development. So that's one way we talk about structuring it. I think another is, and we talk about this all the time as a coaching staff, is we want to recruit the best players we possibly can, because we feel one of the most important parts of development is that they're going out and making each other better. I mean, we can do a ton of coaching, but if players are going out and walking circles around each other in practice, it's not necessarily going to drive individual performance. So if we can have the best possible team, that's who they're really playing against on a daily basis. They're going to play each other more, or compete against each other more in a season than they are anyone else. So let's get the best possible players and people we can, who are going to hold each other accountable, get after each other on the ice, all those things. And that, we feel that's really what drives development more than probably anything we can do as a coach.
We made a really insightful comment there about noticing how the play purpose and potential motivators, you know, they almost intertwine and overlap, right? Like, it's not linear. We've got to split up because that's how books are written, and it helps us understand. But in reality, there's just so much overlap through these different motivators. And I think when you're doing one of these really well, it overflows and helps another motivator, and it becomes this almost a flywheel of compounding positive effects when you start doing it right. But yeah, I think that the individualized approach and creating an environment where the players take responsibility for their own development is absolutely critical. And I also think that so often, and I know I did this too, and I see other coaches that do it, is we actually inadvertently handicap our players by giving them the answers, by planning out everything to a T. Like, it's almost like we put everything so perfect for them that they don't have to make a decision at any point. It's like, hey, walk through the door. Here's where you take off your street clothes. You put on your hockey stuff. Walk down there. Is your protein shake. Here's your fruit. You're gonna go over here. Here's your warm up, and it's just continuous. Where, you know what, sometimes, or all the time actually, it would be better served if we were equipping them to make better decisions. Because what are they going to do when they're not at the rink? How do they make good? They're confronted with choices all the time, and not just for now, but down the road in their future, no matter what they're doing. So I think empowering them to take responsibility is a really important thing. I think when you're reinforcing strengths, it can be so powerful. We have to make sure that weaknesses or limiting factors don't become something that is really holding a player back, but it's their strengths that are really going to make them effective. So can we maximize those? That is, I think, a critical component to helping with potential. And I think the other thing that I think about with this is showing how, as a result of your improvement through effort, things emerge for you. You get more responsibility. It might be like in our case, we have lift leaders. We're preseason right now. So we have players, they're not captains, and they could be sometimes as young as a sophomore, but they're in charge of a lift group, for instance. Like some little thing like that. Hey, you've done a good job. You've earned this opportunity. Now you get this responsibility, this privilege of responsibility. We have big colonels, right? This is somebody who will look after a little colonel on the team, like, you know, as a mentorship type role. And I think these sorts of opportunities, you can work into your program in different ways to reinforce when somebody is improving through their effort.
Yeah, definitely. I think the point you made about basically having every decision that they might need to make already made for them by the time they get to the rink. I mean, this, or otherwise, you know, on road trips or wherever. I mean, I certainly have room for improvement on this still, because, you know, as coaches, we want control at least to a certain extent, or especially as it affects their performance. But, you know, you read all the time about athletes in college who graduate and they don't know what to do with themselves because they've had so much structure. I think we feel like we're doing them a favor by providing that to them, but, you know, just looking with potential, looking beyond just hockey and looking beyond college for them. But have we taught them how to do that themselves? Again, there's certainly room for improvement for me as a coach, but yeah, I mean, even just experientially and talking to some of my classmates when we first graduated, that was something that we really struggled with, because so much was just figured out. You know, we're going to wake up, we're going to lift at this time, we're going to be at the rink again later, you know, and there was hardly time to be creative or to think on our own or have to make decisions. So some of that is just what it is. But I think as coaches, if we can think more about how to develop that, or give them opportunity, like you're talking about, with just even leadership roles that aren't captaincy necessarily, or, hey, you know, so-and-so is going to be in charge of getting us ready for a road trip. You know, it can be something small, packing the bus. It can seem small, but that's another rewarding part of being a coach, is seeing someone who's maybe not comfortable in a leadership role every single day, all season long, but they really take ownership over a certain area. And it seems small, but I think it speaks to potential quite a bit. And it's, it can be such a developer of players, and it can drive performance.
Yeah. We have a teddy bear toss committee, which is actually quite amazing. So we have a teddy bear toss game, like many do. Our teddy bear toss has been around, I want to say, 6-7 years now. When we first started, there weren't that many of those games happening. And it started because of a player who's actually from your neck of the woods, from Winnipeg, Jake Heisinger, who came in as a sophomore and said he wanted to do something for kids at the holidays and who were in the hospital. Didn't know what he wanted to do yet, but we talked about it. Then he came up with, well, let's do a teddy bear toss. I said, okay. Well, what makes our game a little bit different is that we don't exactly have the infrastructure around us that we're going to have another group or outside people plan this whole thing, and we just show up and play and get to pick up the teddy bears when the goal scored. So especially that first year when nobody knew what a teddy bear toss was, our team and our teddy bear toss committee had to educate our fan base, had to figure out where are we getting teddy bears, where to get t-shirts, we're going to sell them, we're going to do all this stuff. They planned all the logistics together, and we played this game. I can tell you, when that goal is scored and the teddy bears come flying, and it's almost always our biggest crowd of the year, it's so meaningful to the players because they're so invested in everything that led up to it. And I think that that's unique and speaks to everything you just said there. And I felt compelled to share it because I'm proud of what our players do every year with that. I would like to get into the idea of pressure. Now that we've covered play purpose and potential, these are the direct motivators that we want to tap into to inspire performance. The one thing that can get in the way of that flywheel that I talked about that could slow down and create friction is this idea of pressure. And you have tremendous experience as a player and as a coach in the national tournament of in those biggest moments when you want your team to play their best and you want your best players to be your best players. And when we feel pressure, it's, and I'll throw a shout out to Bruce Crowley, our mutual friend, who taught me that pressure comes when the outcome is important, the outcome is uncertain, and you feel responsible or you're going to be judged on that outcome. So when it meets those three criteria, that's when we feel pressure. And our role as coaches is to decrease pressure and to mitigate those feelings so that our players feel free and fast and attack mode so that they're playing their best in those moments, not restricted and inhibited. In your experiences as a player and as a coach and what you're doing now, what are some things that you've found to be successful at helping your players decrease the feelings of pressure?
Yeah, it's, I think a big one that I've learned recently that we touched on a bit was just not focusing so much on mistakes. And I think, again, as a coach, you want to have answers. So when players come in and feel like, well, you know, what did I do here? I was on the ice for a goal again. So you want to have an answer for them. But I think just really what that does, and as you mentioned, you might need to do some of that to make sure that it's not inhibiting their game. But as a coach, focusing more on what they're doing well and seeing how that's really what changes their game and drives their performance more than anything, that's been a huge one. And, you know, it's when I think back to, you know, I coached in the national championship game in 2015, and our best line that game was our freshmen. Our third line was a freshman line, all three of them. And they just, we had other players who played well too. It was a fun game, but they were flying right off the bat. And, you know, just, I think when I look back at that game, I've watched it one time since, not maybe twice, but when I watch it, I see them, I think, wow, I mean, that was probably the best game they had all year. And I think for them, they didn't even realize what was on the line, or maybe not quite as much as our juniors and seniors. And, you know, in that game as well, we were playing it in Minneapolis, and we had several kids from that area. And I think for them, there was a little bit of pressure on that game. At the same time, they also got to be back home, which maybe taps into play a little bit. But they were a lot of our older players. And so that younger group, it's just, it was fun to watch them and the way they played in that game, because I don't think they felt the same pressure that those other kids felt, whether it was emotionally on themselves or just, you know, the reward. That's I think economic pressure is what they call that in the book. The reward of winning the game is on a lot of kids' minds too. And as a coach, you almost have to get away from that, in that, which sounds crazy, but in that moment going into the game, you know, you can't be thinking about lifting a trophy at the end. So, you know, those examples come to mind. That line was fun to watch in that game. And I think it was because they really didn't understand what was even, you know, maybe they didn't understand how much was on the line for them, and they played great.
Sort of a blissful ignorance. That's kind of nice. Exactly. Yeah. Well, the other thing that I've talked, and you may have talked with Bruce Crowley about as well, is this idea of the myth of the hero, and how we often sort of look at, you know, Michael Jordan, for example, and other sports figures as clutch performers, and they come up big all the time and all that kind of stuff. But when you actually study the statistics, it's proven that nobody is better than their average in those pressure moments, even Michael Jordan. So Michael Jordan, according to the internet, where I found this, hit 25 game winning shots. And then a famous quote that's attributed to him, he says he's missed the game winning shot 26 times. So he's 25 for 51 in game-winning shots for 49%. His career shooting average was 49.7%. So basically the same. So here's the greatest, most clutch performer in the world. He wasn't better in those moments. He just found a way to be him the same in those moments. We remember those big shots. But I think it's important to recognize that that's the role of pressure. Like, nobody is performing better than they normally do in pressure situations. It's like you can walk along a curb that's 6 inches off the ground all day long, no in balance. But if that curb was 30 feet in the air,
gosh,
could you do it?
I get nervous thinking about it.
Yeah, right? So there we go. There's the pressure of it. And I think a lot of times we inadvertently create pressure for our players. And sometimes it's through our language, like the idea of a must win. Really? It's November. It's not a must win. We don't have to win today. What this is an opportunity to find out where we're at. This is a measuring stick. This is a step along our journey towards that, our ultimate destination that we're working toward, right? It's not a must win. So there's really no situation where dialing up the pressure is going to help, right? It's the same reason why when I've experienced, I did a way more early in my coaching, I'd come in and I'd be upset and maybe I'd kind of lose my temper a little bit. Then they go out on the ice, like they never got better, right? It never improved performance. But I stumbled on it where one day I came in and I was very measured and I talked about, okay, well, that didn't go well. Why didn't it go well? Okay, here's what we're going to do. All right, went out and they played well. What I realized after the fact or years later is that what I actually did was I just reduced pressure on them. What have your experiences been with language?
Oh, it's such a, you know, when you talk about Bruce, I have so much respect for him and he's taught me so much. And this is a big one, just how we talk and what we say. And, you know, one thing he's pointed out is, you know, to your point, you know, is it really helpful to say we need to do this or we should do this, we have to do this, we have to win, it's a must win? Actually, what research shows is to say, here's what we want to do, here's what we'd like to do today. And over time, you know, it sounds like such a small adjustment, and it is once you're cognizant of it, but over time the effect is exactly what you're talking about. It allows players to play at their average or how they typically would play in a pressure situation rather than have performance be inhibited. And, you know, the must win, I have to give this example, or I'd like to give this example of when I was a player. I played with Marissa Gedman. Her dad is Rich Gedman, who played for the Red Sox. He actually caught Roger Clemens' 20 strikeout game, I think it was. So he caught Roger Clemens. He played in the World Series. I mean, just a really well accomplished athlete. And at our games, he was just a dad, you know. And I remember so vividly this conversation. And this was long before I really, you know, this is long before I read this book and learned as much as I have from Bruce. But we lost a Friday game, and you know, I saw him after the game and I wasn't very happy about how it went. And I said, now we have to win tomorrow. You know, for whatever reason, I thought we did. And he, you know, for as accomplished as he is so level headed and he's a coach now. And, you know, he said back, do we have to win tomorrow? And I remember thinking, well, yeah, you know, we do have to, but no, we don't actually, you know. He's like, would it be the end of the world? I think it was mid season too. You know, as a player, you just care so much and you get so worked up. And for whatever reason, I don't even remember the opponent or why I thought it was so important, but he pointed out, you know, and this goes back to language, like why are you putting so much pressure on yourself and the team? Why don't you just go play, going back to play? And I think it explains why he, you know, again, at the time he was just a dad and a fan, but I think it explains why he was such a accomplished athlete and a coach now too in that organization. He paid particular attention to the language piece.
Right. I think this almost comes full circle to the beginning of our conversation, where as coaches, we sometimes get into the trap of thinking that it's our job to motivate our players. I'm going to motivate them today. I'm going to take my dry erase marker, and I'm going to write must win as big as I can on the whiteboards. So when they walk in, man, they know this is a must win, and they're going to go out and they're going to get this thing done. When in reality, that's like the biggest mistake you can do, because you're just creating some pressure, you know, for no reason. And I think we could go on and on forever in this conversation. And I really appreciate your insight. And I thank you so much for coming on and joining me for this conversation.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast. It's so fun. Like you said, we could go on and on, but I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.